we need actually the challenges that we face that are inside of us. That's how we grow in self-mastery. And so there's no magic pill. Same with people like who are really set on like, I need an anti-anxiety medicine. Just give me a pill that will make my anxiety go away. Well, again, there's no pill that gives you self-mastery. And self-mastery is worth having anxiety. It's worth having attention problems. It's worth having whatever the struggles are that we face so that we can grow in self-mastery and eventually get into these virtuous cycles where we love growing in these ways.
Before we get started, if you enjoy these episodes, you might want to explore more at optimorg.com. Our website offers unique content, tools, and exercises to help you thrive at work and beyond. We have an in-depth masterclass which covers our entire theory of growth. We have daily recommendations for personalized advice, and we have a platform to help groups and organizations learn and practice optimal work together. You can get a free trial at optimorg.com. Now let's get started with today's episode. Hey, this is Sharif here with another episode of the Optimal Work Podcast, joined by Dr. Kevin Majors. Kevin, great to be here with you again.
Hey, Sharif, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kevin, I was recently helping you as you were preparing to give a talk, and one of the ideas that struck me and that you had developed in one of the draft and ultimately that I think you delivered was the idea that habits and virtues are about shaping the brain's predictions. And we talk a lot about predictions. I think we did a two-part series on predictions, shaping your brain's predictions a while ago. But I'd always thought of the idea of virtue as about shaping the emotions, not about shaping predictions. So this seems like a really interesting idea. So I thought this episode we could dive into that. And then the related ideas of virtue, how to grow in virtue, the relationship between ideals and virtues and so forth. How's that sound?
That sounds great.
Okay, well, great. Maybe we could start with this whole prediction question. So I don't know if you could just explain the thought there for us.
Yeah, sure. The idea here is that the essence of a vicious cycle is that, and what is a vice, is that we are locked into negative predictions of failing when tested in a certain way. So if you believe that, you know, for instance, if you had young kids, you felt that you will always lose your temper and start yelling, you know, that belief, not necessarily consciously held, like you reflect on it, oh yeah, this is what I believe, but just that this is what is the kind of rote thing that your brain now predicts that when your patience is tested, it will fail. So vice in this sense is like a prediction of failure. And in that way, it's interesting to think that kind of being pessimistic about our own, I don't know, moral, I don't know, strength, you know, and what happens when we're tested, pessimism there really turns the predictions into a self-fulfilling prophecy. So then every time we get provoked, we end up losing our patience because we just, you know, we have this fixed kind of belief that this is what happens. But if you look a little more deeply, it's just that in fact, what we're experiencing on the inside, you know, when this whole scenario plays out, there's a trigger and then there's our kind of automatic response. All of that represents what has been predicted to happen. So the question then is like, how do you get freedom from these negative predictions of failing when tested? And that's the exciting thing about what reframing does. That when a person reframes, you know, he or she has to think of the testing in a new light so that now they can see the possibility of changing course right in the midst of the testing. And in fact, in ways that you can only do when tested. So that would mean you're provoked by the kids, you feel like you're going to lose your temper, and instead you see that, okay, this is exactly what I need. You can reframe that in advance so that you can see this is what you need to develop in a new way, to develop a new pattern of acting. So reframing gives us a kind of deliberate ability to start influencing our predictions. So you just have an image of it in your mind, and now that image can become at least a competing prediction with the old one of just always acting the same way.
Mm-hmm. So this idea of predictions, I think, seems new. Is it based on like developments in neuroscience, or is this something, would you equate the predictions with emotions? Because I'm just trying to understand how this all has developed.
This is coming from, one of the top psychiatrists or neuropsychiatrists in the world today is Carl Friston. And Friston is the one who I think has most pioneered the idea of the predictive brain, that basically the main thing that our brains do is try to predict what we're going to do next. And it tries to get that down to a few possibilities, or ideally one possibility, because it's just energy efficient. Lisa Feldman-Barrett is another researcher who talks about emotions as predictions. And she has a book called How Emotions Are Made. I think a lot of the approach, unfortunately, suffers from a kind of reductionism of the experience of emotion to the neurological, to the extent that in the end, she doesn't think you can even talk about emotion as a thing. So like fear is not one thing because it's not neurologically one thing. But I think that what is missing, I think, sometimes from neuroscience is they just get so drilled down into, well, is it this pathway in the brain? Is it that pathway in the brain? What exactly is being activated in fear? And turns out it can be many different things. Well, that doesn't mean there's no such thing as fear. It just means that you might not be able to reduce it to a particular pattern of acting in the brain. But we humans have the experience of fear, and we know what it is when there is some kind of future evil that is avoidable. That by flight, and then so we can feel this urge to flee it. So that's a pretty good sense of like what fear is. At any rate, all of that is to say that, yeah, so emotions are seen as a predicted readiness to act a certain way. But then a virtue, like particularly a moral virtue, which are virtues that deal with emotions, that would be seen as a higher order prediction of, while being provoked, still acting in the best way. So still being patient with the kids, or still being patient with your coworkers, even though you're triggered. And so eventually there's this kind of freedom from triggering. Not that it doesn't happen, but that it just doesn't matter how big the triggering is, because you've achieved a kind of irrelevance. You are now, you have such a strong prediction of staying deliberate, staying in control, that it doesn't even matter how much you get triggered.
Before we continue, a brief message. If you're benefiting from these discussions, please hit like and subscribe to our channel. Doing so helps us reach more people. So you're not just learning yourself, you're helping others discover a path to growth and flourishing too. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy the rest of the episode. Yeah, okay, the question just arose. I'm not sure if it's a kind of random technical logical question or if it's actually important, but if with courage, you said you have this higher order prediction, and we often say, and I think this is part of the tradition, that courage is when you have fear present, then you can be courageous. So if fear is the result of a negative prediction, and then having courage is a second order, higher level positive prediction. So do you have both of the predictions going on at the same time? How does that work?
Yeah. So to the extent that a person has fear, that is because there's a predicted readiness of flight that is required. And so your body readies to flee. Okay. Now that readiness can be present. But if a person has courage, then they're able to, no matter how strong that is, still do the courageous thing. So still, like, for instance, if you're in a war situation, to still fight, even though you have a contrary urge to flee. So is it important for courage that the person have a great degree of fear? I don't think so. Courage doesn't imply fear is great. And then you could ask, is it important that there be no fear? And you'd also have to say, no, I think, right? That courage, in fact, doesn't imply anything about the degree of fear that's present. It only says that it's irrelevant to shaping the action. That's a hugely important thing. That courage, you is so, because what can happen is when people feel fear, they could then think, ooh, now that I'm afraid, I can't be courageous. But it's important that people have the sense that no, the real thing here is you can be committed to the ideal of courage. And that at the same time, just accept whatever level of fear might be present. So that's a huge understanding, I think, of how freedom works. We do not have control over our emotions directly, but we do have control over our actions, and we always have the freedom to shape our action while accepting the emotion. You go through the other, like anger. So what's the virtue that applies to anger is called meekness. Okay, so meekness means that you now have a habit of staying calm no matter how great your anger is. Again, it doesn't imply anything about how big or little your anger is. It's just that you can stay calm no matter how angry you are. So again, meekness makes anger irrelevant to your action. So meekness is about anger because it's the ability to stay free and deliberate while you're angry, but it doesn't say anything about how big or small the anger is. We talked about humility is like that with shame. Confidence is like that with self-doubt. So to be confident as a person is that you can act confidently regardless of self-doubt, whether it's high, whether it's low. So that's why we don't need to, like, self-esteem is trying to get confidence by minimizing self-doubt. That misses the point that the real shaping is the irrelevance you achieve for how much self-doubt you have so that you can still act confidently no matter what. So in that sense, you have this higher level prediction of acting confidently that can encompass any degree of self-doubt that's triggered as a kind of contrary prediction.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of—
I said predictions here, only talk about the neurology. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Can you, what do you mean by that? Only to talk about the neurology?
I'm not trying to say that the virtues are, properly speaking, just predictions in our brain. So I actually think that they're really more in our mind because I think confidence is more a quality of the mind of the person, and same with courage. So I think all these things are in some ways the ability of our mind to be directing our action while accepting the emotion that goes against it. But I do think that there's a correlation in the brain that what happens through this kind of repetition is that the predictions for virtuous action get stronger and stronger and stronger. So I'm in talking about virtuous prediction, I think that's only at the neurological level, but that's not really the subjective level. It knows you, it's your conscious mind that in fact is the subject of all these virtues.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then also the emotion is not purely the prediction, it's kind of downstream of the prediction too.
That's true.
It reminds me of the image they use for reframing of these kind of these concentric circles where the interior is the challenge, the pain, the innermost circle. And then to reframe it, you have to widen the context to see it and to see the opportunity for growth, learning, practice. So reframing is not about getting rid of the challenge or the pain or whatever it is, but seeing it in a wider context, not invalidating that perception of challenge, but seeing. And then similarly, the virtue, it's not about getting rid of the emotion, which is like kind of the inner circle, but it's about widening the context, expanding things out to see.
Yeah, the idea here is that you have to have in your mind the image of a target. Mm-hmm. And if you just think of, like, subtract that outer layer, and now you have like a spotlight shining on the core, the middle red dot, that's what happens when we view things in a narrow negative light. It just highlights how bad that thing is, you know, the anger or the, you know, the impatience or the shame. What every virtue does is it widens out to see that there's actually another ring, which is what it's like. It encompasses the inner target, but now you can see it as an opportunity for growth in the relevant virtue. So meekness encompasses anger, humility encompasses shame, confidence encompasses that core of self-doubt, but that's greater than it.
Yeah, Kevin. Okay, so now I want to, if we can turn to the question of ideals and loop that in here, because oftentimes, and on the optimalwork.com, on the website, things are frequently put in terms of ideals. So what is the difference between ideals and virtues, and why do we tend to talk about ideals?
Yeah, it's a great question. So ideals are basically virtues that you are aiming to attain through practice. So they're inexhaustible. You can always have greater, so say like, you know, the greatest of ideals is love. And so you can always be more loving. And so, but it still can guide your current action. The reason we use ideals is because you can know whether or not you're aiming for a particular ideal. It's actually a behavior that you do that you can measure. So you can say, how many times today did I consciously aim at being more cheerful, being more generous, you know, being more thoughtful? So you can take any ideal and be aiming for ways that you want to be practicing it. And that's what matters most, because that then becomes a real core element of reframing challenges, because there is always an ideal that corresponds to a challenge that would make that challenge easy or even enjoyable to do. So that's the kind of magic of the ideal. The ideal allows us to think of this new way of being in the challenge that is turning it into growth in that moment. And then we grow by means of the challenge. So we need the light of ideals to be able to robustly reframe any challenge. And I think the normal limitation in CBT or any form of psychotherapy is it's powerful insofar as people are really leveraging ideals to attain growth. But if you don't have a really clear concept of reframing, then ideals fall out of it. And reframing just becomes trying to think positively. But being positive isn't really an ideal. So ideals are richer than that. So I think courage is a much richer concept than positivity in the face of a challenge.
Right. So with a virtue, the idea is that a virtue is a habit that you possess something inside you, and you don't want to focus as much on that, because I don't know, do you get into kind of, okay, how much virtue am I, like, you're just starting to measure yourself and it's becoming focused on yourself and it's less helpful to target your future behavior, whereas ideals, it's purely outside of you, something that you aim for, so it's always going to be motivating?
Yeah, I think that's right. And so we can never know to what extent we possess a particular virtue. So we can have an idea that, okay, well, I'm not like losing my temper. But does that, like, even if you could quantify virtue, what good would be served by doing it? I don't think it helps us then to stretch ourselves more. Because if you have if I were to think of myself as, I'm just like a cheerful, happy-go-lucky guy. Well, okay, that, you know, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but is that going to make me better to live with if I have this really fixed idea? No, the more I have this fixed idea, the less I'm going to be striving. So I think it's much better that we be in a position of looking actively for ideals, and that this becomes a way of living, that we're trying to think deliberately of, like, how could I be more loving in this next task? How could I be more generous? So that way we're always striving in some way according to really the light of these ideals. Now, the habits we have, that's what we can talk about virtues as predictions to some extent. We're talking about, like, in the brain, they're predictions. Because then now we're talking about the habit that's been formed through practice. And so that's something that we possess. Now, probably someone could kind of get to the point where they know that no matter, I don't know, well, it's hard to say no matter how much. I was going to say no matter, like, how much fear I have, I can still do the courageous thing. But I haven't experienced every kind of fear. So who knows? I think there are some species of fear that we don't really know if we can, you know, like, what we're going to be like when we, because we have never faced those kinds of challenges before. So we have no knowledge of a habit. I mean, how many times have I faced death? You know, none. And so, like, I don't have a habit of facing up to that particular fear. So again, it's, like, hard to know, like, do I, is it guaranteed then that we would, well, again, courage is ultimately not about having no fear. So it's just about being disposed to act courageously no matter how much fear we have. So I think it's better that we never rest at some level that we're at, as if that's where like a stable possession that we have, but we're always striving to be growing and improving.
Yeah. And okay, so, and then just to follow up on that, because you brought up this, the last point of, yeah, do I know that I have enough of this virtue to face up to this particular challenge? It seems a much, yeah, that it would could lead to a kind of avoidance. If you're thinking in terms of virtue, you might think, okay, well, I'm just, given where I'm at, I'm not, you're trying to assess yourself, I'm not virtuous enough to handle this situation. Whereas with an ideal, you're going to be more likely to kind of step outside of your comfort zone and take on a new challenge.
Yeah, because not just to jump in, but what you're pointing out is really great, that virtues lend themselves to more self-labels. So then you can label yourself as having some quality, like, oh yeah, so I'm patient, I'm generous. But that labels go more with fixed mindset. And ideals go more with growth mindset, that I'm going to look for opportunities to continue to grow in this way. And it is the natural thing of virtuous cycles that we develop a greater and greater enthusiasm for growing in that particular way. So ideally, so to speak, we would always be on the lookout for ways of growing in the ways that we have already grown. And so the more we really have tried to be more, say, sincere and more, humble, well, in fact, we come to love sincerity and humility even more. And we love exercising them. So we're not looking for a time when we never have contrary, emotions to struggle with. We're never looking for a time when somehow we've achieved total inner peace with no inner resistance. So I think this is actually one of the things I'm just to throw out there that can be dangerous about the way people are approaching psychedelics right now, that they're looking for some kind of magic pill that will dissolve their inner resistance to growth. As if like we'll be able to just take this, do this, psilocybin in controlled circumstances with a good therapist is what they say. And then you'll just dissolve this inner resistance. You dissolve whatever the obstacle is inside of you, some, deeply exiled emotion. I think that's really misguided. I think the whole, we need our inner resistances. We need the kind of the thing, we need actually the challenges that we face that are inside of us. That's how we grow in self-mastery. And so there's no magic pill. Same with people who are really set on I need an anti-anxiety medicine. Just give me a pill that will make my anxiety go away. Well, again, there's no pill that gives you self-mastery. And self-mastery is worth having anxiety. It's worth having attention problems. It's worth having whatever the struggles are that we face so that we can grow in self-mastery and eventually get into these virtuous cycles where we love growing in these ways. And that's how, then we start to help everyone around us. So I think that that's a much more important thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of, we talk about outcome goals versus growth goals. And I think sometimes you can have outcomes for your own growth. So I just want to be this certain way. So it's normally we talk about outcomes as I want to achieve this particular thing. But you can also think, well, I just, you get the sense, I want to be this way, and you can take shortcuts to get there. So, and then just to follow up on—
That's exactly right, yeah.
What do you think about these strategies? You mentioned anti-anxiety medication and other magic pills. What do you think about techniques that people use to deal with distraction, like, blocking social media channels on their computer or— various techniques like that. Are those also just kind of reducing the challenge in a way, or what's your sense there?
Yeah, so the question for any strategy is this helping me to see the challenge in a fully positive light? Because that light of the reframe is a new kind of prediction you're shaping. So if a person is, if a person is, for instance, let's say that a person is like has a game on their phone, tic-tac-toe. Okay, let's just say there's this game, and they get constantly drawn to playing it. Is it better for them to delete it from their phone? Or is it better that they have it there and not give in to the urge to check it? So to some extent, in terms of their growth and self-mastery, I think that they should at least view having it on their phone as a form of practice, particularly because it's not necessarily a big deal if they give in and play a little bit. So there is a sense that, okay, if they really wanted to get tic-tac-toe out of their life, they could be like showing great commitment by deleting it from their phone. But we just want to make sure that there's not a subtle pessimism in there that says, I'll never be able to thrive in the face of this kind of challenge. Like I'll always be my predictions that like, because desire is a prediction that will partake of something. So my desirous predictions will always be able to overrule my self-mastery. That I think is the tricky thing. We don't want people to have this idea that they're somehow, yeah. So it's not about preventing times of testing. It's about reframing the testing itself. Now, there are some areas where I think it can be fine that people actually do some, like you don't want necessarily to be exposed to every ad. Okay, can you have an ad blocker on your browser? Absolutely. So, and I think there's a lot of good reasons for doing that. But it's also just because you're kind of cutting down on friction and noise in your life so that you're kind of pre-committing yourself to work well. So I think that there's, I don't know if I'm being clear, but I think there's a balance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, then one other strategy I wanted to run by you is, I don't know, I've been accused of having an extreme personality or an addictive personality. I don't know what you think about that phrase, but so that's like a self-label that I have. So I find it easier to say that, okay, I'm just going to do zero of this thing. So for instance, I stopped eating sugar some time ago. And I said, okay, I'm just never going to eat sugar. And then now it's kind of easy for me to resist it once I make that commitment. I just don't eat sugar. But if I say, well, I'm going to have dessert twice a week, then now it's someone's birthday, so I have it three times, and there's some other celebration, so it's four times. And then I gradually just, now I'm having it every day again or something. So I just find it easier to say never. Is that a bad strategy, or is that kind of the same thing?
But there, it seems like then you've turned never into an outcome.
Uh huh.
That you can control. So it's like saying for sure, if you were in a habit of doing it only twice a week, gradually that would be easy to do. So there is a persuadability in your emotions, like in the craving for sugar, that isn't being exercised if it's completely zero. And at least it's not being exercised in the same way as if it's once a week or twice a week or only on certain special occasions. So I think you can have a certain guideline and think, what's a reasonable amount of sugar to have in your life? You may decide it's actually zero and that's fine. But let's say that you think that, no, I think it's okay to stress my system kind of hormetically with sugar twice a week. Which is probably what it's doing. And then you can, whatever seems to be the difficulty, like when the third occasion comes, that's what you look forward to. So that means if you had twice in 1 week, you are looking forward to the moment when the third comes so that you can get used to practicing saying no to it then. So I think sometimes these doing things in moderation is, it lets you develop the virtue of being temperate more than complete abstinence, provided these aren't things that are like essentially bad and harmful.
Right. And I shouldn't have asked that question. I knew you were going to say that. Now I have to change. Okay. Well, Kevin, that's all I have in terms of questions today. So I don't know if there's any final thoughts you want to add for us.
Maybe just this idea of persuasion, you know, that it's good to see that we are always capable of persuading our own emotions. And what Thomas Aquinas says is the way we persuade them, it's not through commands. You can't command yourself to have no desire for sugar if you have a habit of sugar. You just can't command that. And sometimes maybe that's what people are trying to do with overly strict rules or bright lines. But we do shape ourselves, he says, politically, not despotically. You know, we convince our passions to come along. And the way you persuade your emotions, he says, is through repetition. So repetition is persuasion for the emotions. So like the most noble part of us, our mind, ends up persuading the feelings that we have through repetition. And they, you know, AA has this famous saying, right feeling follows right acting. So the mind shapes the action, accepts the contrary emotion, and gradually that emotion habituates in the background. So it just gets easier and easier and easier then for your brain to kind of predict better what you're going to do. Your brain doesn't want to waste energy on making wrong predictions. But that whole thing can be seen as that, like, you're trusting in your persuadability. You just have to like hold to what you think is right, and gradually the feelings come along.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, Kevin. Well, I think that's a great optimistic note for us to end on.
Great, Sharif. Thanks for your questions.
All right. Thanks a lot. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. If you enjoyed our conversation and you're looking for more in-depth guidance, check out optimalwork.com, our platform of content, tools, and exercises that will help you thrive at work and beyond. See you next week.